And so while I was running in almost full-time practice, I took some classes and worked in research, and one thing led to another, bada boom, bada bing. I ended up getting my PhD. You know, you think it's going to be my baby or something like that.
As one does, you know, I'll just do some night school and I'll just pop out with a PhD. Yep.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body balance, and inner badass, these are the themes we are exploring.
Before we jump into the interview, I want to invite you to join our free Facebook community, Legacy. If you want to be something amazing, you need to surround yourself with amazing people. The Legacy community is made up of badass women living, not leaving, but living our legacy every single day. We are leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, and innovators collectively committed to leaving the world better than we found it. My mission is to support the health and optimization of these badass superheroes, literally to places we never thought imaginable. If you are on a mission and get it that your health is the key to your unlimited potential, then join us. We are super awesome. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/BE Legacy. See you there.
My guest today was Dr. Rishma Walji. Dr. Walji has been a naturopathic doctor and studying naturopathic medicine for over 20 years, and she also has a PhD in pharmaceutical science from the University of Toronto. The combination is outstandingly interesting because what I really wanted to get into is how that PhD had sculpted and changed her approach to practice. And what we really saw is that it re-solidified the need to go back to the fundamentals of naturopathic medicine. The most interesting part of this conversation today, and there were a ton of interesting parts, was looking at the notion of boundaries and how they impact us as effective practitioners, as consumers of healthcare, as entrepreneurs, as parents, as fundamental KPIs of our health. This was a super fascinating interview for anyone who has ever struggled with boundaries. And I explain this in the interview, but here's a really quick snapshot. If you are finding that you are driving down the road and you are getting angry, that you are snippy with the people standing in front of you in line, that your kids are driving you crazy, I can almost assure you that your boundaries have melted a long time ago. And we're going to talk about the importance of having them in play, along with some of the other fundamental and foundational pieces of health that are going to keep you performing at your absolute best. Dr. Rishma Walji is incredibly talented. She has a diverse background. She's an entrepreneur. She's an adventurer. She is a mother, and she has so much to share. And it is my absolute pleasure to share her with you now.
Dr. Rishma Walji, welcome to the Entrepology Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to jump into our conversation today and really delve into your journey and your background. You are an academic, you are a naturopathic doctor, you've worked in brick and mortar, you are looking at online stuff. You've got a really eclectic and strong background in terms of talking about unique approaches to care. Take us through your journey and your career and tell us how you got to where you are right now.
Okay, well, I guess I'll start with when I got into naturopathic medicine. It was maybe, I guess, 20 years ago. I went into it with a very sort of scientific educational background, but I'm also a first generation Canadian. I grew up with my grandparents. And so I had these sort of seeds of, you know, traditional philosophy and wisdom that had sort of been planted into my mind. And so while I was studying, it was very transformative for me to see the power that these two approaches, like Eastern and Western, could have, especially when they work together. So, I mean, almost from day one, I was really blown away by the changes that people could experience with their health. And then I graduated from the college and I went into clinical practice. And to be honest, it was actually really frustrating. Back then, our profession didn't really have the same recognition and voice that it has now. And so I would have patients who had really complex health issues, and I wasn't able to get access to their health records or communicate with their health team. I mean, I felt like I was treating them with my one hand behind my back. You know, it's really hard to get anything done when you just can't work at your full capacity. And so I felt sort of a responsibility, not only for my patients, but also to my colleagues to help to move our profession forward. And so while I was running an almost full-time practice, I took some classes and worked in research, and one thing led to another, bada boom, bada bing. I ended up getting my PhD. You know, you think it's going to be my baby or something like that.
As one does, you know, I'll just do some night school and I'll just pop out with a PhD. Yeah.
Yeah, it did feel like that. It was like, wow, you know, what happened here? But it sort of was a whirlwind. And then I ended up doing a lot of work in academia and research, still in clinical practice. I was able to teach other health professionals at various universities, and I worked in health policy for a while. And it was a really great experience. I ended up after that coming full circle because I was at the time opening up my third clinical practice. And I was being considered for an academic position at a university. Now, by this time, I had two kids, and I knew that a decision like this was really going to change the way my career was going to go. And I realized, as much as I loved what I had been doing and as much as I felt like I had been making a difference, my real passion was still working with patients. And so now my clinical practice is my focus. And my new outlet or project, because, you know, you always have to have one, is to try to get my knowledge and skills out to more people, because I feel like I have this sort of unique background. So I've been kind of testing the waters with blogging and, you know, just sort of seeing what's going on digitally and learning that side of it and trying to get my knowledge out in a different way, but more directly to consumers.
Yeah, I really like that. And I want to delve into this because, well, you have a quote that I found on your Instagram, or I found on your website that was linked to your Instagram. It doesn't really matter how I found it, but it relates to this concept of quote unquote real medicine. And you said, if it helps you heal, it is real medicine. And I would really love to hear from your perspective, because we have practitioners who listen, we have consumers who listen, and there's a lot of, for people who are bought in, as it were, to naturopathic medicine or functional medicine or natural healing, they're like, it's just a given. Like, this is a philosophy and an approach that works. And for people who don't, they still think of it as a belief system. They don't believe in it. So having engaged on that academic side, and the last time I saw you present was actually at a primary care physicians conference for doctors, for MDs. Like, take us through the change and perspective, and like, what happened once you got that PhD and you started to look at naturopathic medicine from the other side? Because I think as practitioners and as patients who are bought in, we're like, we want our argument strengthened, but we also want to add to the perspective of the other.
Yeah. You know, I've always sort of believed, so to speak, in both sides. I think there is a place for everything. There is a place for Western medicine. There's a place for whatever you want to call it, traditional Eastern medicine. I think the biggest challenge is working together. And so I think there is this sort of belief that everything works in silos. So whether you're either bought in or you think it's, you know, placebo or whatever that may be. So I think things have changed certainly since I started in the profession. Consumers are really interested in it. It's much more mainstream. And, you know, you go to a party and natural health is always sort of a big conversation, the new product that's out or the new diet that's out. So there's always a big interest, I think, in what we do. And so things have definitely changed. And I've noticed that a lot. On the healthcare side, even with, you know, conventional docs or other health providers, I think things have certainly changed as well, but it takes more time and there's a bit of a slower sort of uptake to it. I think at the end of the day, though, the bottom line is we want to get our patients better. And so there is an issue where I feel like sometimes we give, whether it be pharmaceuticals or natural health products, that don't make people feel better and they don't make them progress into a more healthy state. And then there's sometimes when we give them something, we have no idea why it helped them, but it really did. And so I think that's the struggle that various health providers have. So on the other end, you know, they're thinking, well, I don't get the science. How can it possibly work? And on our end, we're thinking, well, the patient's getting better. You know, so I think if we can just combine the two and have people really work together to understand that the bottom line is always patient outcome. If the patient is going to feel better, you're doing the right thing. If the patient is healing and they're on their way to recovery, you're doing the right thing. And I tell my patients all the time, if you're taking a Tylenol for your headache, that's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that if you need to get through your day. But if you're taking a Tylenol every single day for a month, there's something wrong there. That's not helping you. That's a Band-Aid.
Yeah. And I talk about risk a lot because one of the populations I get really frustrated working with, I'm saying this very openly and publicly, our gastroenterologists, if you are listening, listen up, because I find that it's so easy to make very simple dietary changes for patients and see significant change in day-to-day symptoms for a lot of patients with inflammatory bowel disease. And they go back to their doctor, who totally minimizes that change and effort. One, it's empowering for the patient, and two, it's working. And they really get their knickers in a knot about saying there's no evidence that food's connected and there's all these pieces. But what I don't understand is we get so obsessed with evidence, but we never talk about risk. And the risk profile of naturopathic medicine and functional medicine is very low when you, well, it's very low, period, because people are very well trained in it. But the risk of pursuing a diet that's creating harm, like there's really zero risk in supporting a patient and making some of these really monumental changes. And I would love for the conversation to also move from having to have evidence for every last thing, because different models of science find evidence in different ways. And I'd love to talk to you about that. But I think we also need to talk about risk, the risk associated with trying some of those modalities, and the risks of continuing without some of the naturopathic modalities are actually quite high for patients.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the risk of not changing your diet is certainly much, much larger than it is of actually changing your diet. So I think that long-term care is really important. And the issue is, I think a lot of times when you're waiting to see your specialist or whatever it is, you're waiting for 6 months and you get a few minutes with your doctor. So I think there is this sort of lack in the system where you can't actually move forward because there isn't that conversation piece. And I think that is part of the barrier of working together, is you don't have that opportunity to have that conversation piece.
And so how do patients do that? Because, you know, our audience are consumers, so they're like, okay, great, all well and good that you guys are frustrated as practitioners, that it's sometimes difficult to have a conversation. And I will say it's not always difficult. I have a lot of great conversations with physicians as well. But if you're the patient trying to navigate between, listen, I've got a great family doctor and I respect what they do for me, but I also have an amazing functional medicine doc or chiropractor or whatever it is, what sort of things should be infused in their dialogue with their practitioners so that they ease the risk of tension, as it were?
Yeah, this is actually a really touchy subject. I have a lot of patients who broach this with me and say, you know, how do I talk to my doctor? And the first question I always ask them is, what is your relationship with your doctor? Do you know them? Do they know you? And, you know, how are you going to be able to start this conversation? Is it going to be a controversial one? Because you have to approach it in a way that works for your doctor. You kind of have to know their personality. And just like you said, I've had some amazing conversations. And over time, when you work in one location, you end up getting to know the different practitioners. So I've been able to develop a relationship with various practitioners in my area, which makes it a lot easier when someone says the name of their doctor and I recognize that person. But if it's someone who maybe has a bit more of a hesitation to talk to their doctor, usually what I tell them is just understand your doctor is also trying to give you the best care that they know how. They might not know about naturopathic medicine. They might not know about how influential dietary change can be, and they might not be able to coach you through that process, but they are in their own way trying to get you to feel better, and they're trying to get you to a place of health. And so they've learned their medicine differently. They have a different business model. They only have 5 minutes, whereas I have an hour I can spend to get into all this detail. So the way that I coach my patients is I tell them to optimize their time. So if you're going to present your concerns, present them in a logical flow of symptoms. You know, bring your lab reports in a chronological sequence so that your doctor can see everything. They're able to make a diagnostic impression in a logical and organized fashion, because their end goal is the same end goal as mine. They want the patient to get to a place of health. And so if that means that they're going to be doing it with diet and exercise and whatever else that I've recommended to them, then as long as there's a logical flow of, you know, this is my symptom, this is what I'm doing about it, these are how my lab results look, there's much more likelihood that that doctor is going to get on board and try to work together.
I love your reference to, like, put them all in your logical order and the sequence. I was like, I could hear your PhD oozing out of that advice. That's totally.
You got to speak the language, right? Like you have to actually get the message that you want to get across in a language that they speak.
Yeah. And I also say to patients, I want you just to assume that this person has your absolute best intentions at heart.
Exactly.
And I just find when we change those assumptions, it changes our approach to people overall.
For sure.
What is your approach to practice? So with a very strong academic background, I would presume, but I probably shouldn't, that there are elements of naturopathic care and certain modalities that you gravitate to more than others. What is your approach with patients?
Oh, such an interesting question. You know, it's been a real interesting transition for me because everything I do academically is focused on a very scientific model. So I did, you know, natural health product research, and I worked in health policy around the safety of natural health products. But I found it very interesting that when you go into that avenue, it's very much scientifically, like the same way, you know, oh, you have blood pressure problems, let's look at these natural health products. Or, oh, you know, you have cardiovascular, let's look at. And so it was very prescriptive, like this product for this condition. And so as much as I think I was able to help with the professional understanding between other health providers, because that's what they understood. If I said, you know, there's research around, you know, St. John's Wort or Q10 or whatever it was, they understood that. But when I'm in practice, I don't actually treat people that way. I treat people as if they are real people because, hey,
no.
They are. And so I ask them about their stress and about their, you know, their diet and their exercise. And what I find is the limitations on their health progress are not that they're taking too many supplements or they're not taking enough supplements. I actually rarely prescribe supplements unless I really feel like the person needs them. Really, what I'm looking at are their obstacles to health. And usually it involves some kind of emotional or understanding of their body. So I do a ton of acupuncture. I do a ton of counseling. I spend inordinate amounts of time explaining things. So before I get into supplements, I'll say, you know, if you don't drink, I can say drink water as much as I want, but if they don't understand what the water does for them in their body, they're not going to drink it. And I don't want to just give them, you know, 10 supplements to try to help them get rid of their headaches. You know, if they're dehydrated, start with the water. So I think I have a very grassroots approach to practice, which sounds probably different than what you would expect.
No, but I think that's the reality for so many people. So let's just get really specific there, because I know people are like, water, I don't drink enough water. She's so right. So because people are going to, they need a hook. Why
yes.
do we need to drink so much water?
So you want me to explain why you need
yeah.
water?
I know why you need water, but I think that this is a really great example of basics that people don't do. And the very first podcast guest I ever had was Sachin Patel. And he said on that podcast episode, and I say this all the time, consistency built the canon or the canyon. And I believe that. And I talk about this with patients every day. I don't care about what you do twice a year. I care about what you do every single day, because what you do every day is what is actually going to tell your biological story. And so not drinking enough water is something people do every single day. And I think it's because they actually don't understand with enough conviction why it's helpful for them. So yeah. You, Dr. Walji, are about to change their mindset on that.
I am. You know what? I do. I tell people about the reason they need water. Like, your circulation can't go without your water. You know, if you drink, you know, 6 cups of coffee because you're tired, you're getting dehydrated and your body thinks it's a desert. And so, you know, you release this hormone from your brain and your body tells yourself, I'm a desert. And people say, well, when I drink water, I have to go to the bathroom all the time. And I'm like, yeah, it's because your body has no idea what to do with this water that you're all of a sudden drinking. You've been sitting in the Sahara for how many months, you know? So it takes time for your body to understand that this water is now coming on a regular basis, and you're not just going to guzzle it all at the end of the day when you're feeling parched, right? So I usually tell people that the first thing you need to do is get your water, get your vegetables, and get your tools that your body needs to actually work, right? Get the tools that your body needs so that everything else can make sense. So even if I give you supplements or I give you vitamins, if there is no proper circulation in your body, if your body's dehydrated, you're not getting that circulation to all the parts of your body. None of the supplements are going to do anything for you. You actually have to have the tools, the very basics, before we can get to the next level.
What do you see as being the most common thing that people aren't doing but could, like, on that spectrum of simple things aside from the consumption of water, what things do you see over and over again that you're like, like, if we could just move the needle on this, like, we would see big changes?
So water is a huge one. Sleep is another really, really big one, not necessarily just quantity but also quality. So some of it is quality and some of it is quantity, and people think they need much less than a lot of times they do. Vegetables is the other one. We're not trained to eat the vegetables, you know, and I think so. Water, nutrients, sleep. And the other one, I think, is stress management, because we are always sort of in this fight or flight, you know, I'm running from a lion in the jungle. And we don't realize that in our modern society, the lion is your deadline and your screaming kid. And, you know, you're running around to do something else. Like, you never actually take a break. And sleep, in my mind, doesn't count. Sleep is restorative. That's not rest and digest. That's, you know, you need that to restore yourself. So we don't spend enough time, I think, in sort of a rest and digest phase. We're always running from another lion. So those are sort of the consistent things. And I think you're right. You know, it's not about what you do once a year or twice a year. What I tell people is, you know, if you buy a car, you're told, they give you a sticker, you know, you have to change your oil every 3 months, and you are, or every, you know, certain number of kilometers. No one sticks a sticker on my head and says, drink water and eat veggies, you know. And if we did, I think we would be much better off, because we would be proactively preventing the health problems later on.
Well, and the funny thing is people do change the oil in their car, and they do take their dogs for walks. Like, I find this so funny. I hear the people say this all the time. They're like, oh, Ralphie's gained like 5 extra pounds. We got to get him out to the park. And I'm like, the irony of the situation is so profound to me, because people are on mm-hmm. top of their dog's weight, mm-hmm. but they're not necessarily on top of their own metrics of health. Mm-hmm. And if we were to look at that in terms of metrics of health, and we talked a little bit about things that people can do, what are some of the key things that people should be tapping into? And in terms of listening to their body, because you opened with that. You opened with this idea that you see in your patients, and how you approach care is really like getting people to connect back to their body. Like, what mm-hmm. kind of key performance indicators of their own health should people be looking at? And then maybe even asking their ND or their doctor to run in terms of testing.
Yeah, I think the biggest one is energy. So that's sort of an elusive one. It could be caused by so many issues, but energy is a really big factor I find when I see in my patients. If they're tired, there could be many actual physical health issues where they're maybe low in iron, or they have a thyroid issue, or whatever it is. But if you are low in energy, your body is telling you something. You're not functioning properly. So I think that's a really big one. It could be related to sleep, or it could be actually something more serious in their body they have to look into. And energy is a big one. I think another one is mental happiness, I guess, you know, just mental clarity, because what we don't realize is our stress sort of weighs on us. And if you're not happy, you're not motivated to eat well, you're not motivated to exercise, you know, you might be down on yourself, you might not have confidence, you might have a poor relationship. So that mental health, and there is also real mental health, you know, in terms of depression, anxiety, but I think even the general population, if you're at this stage where you're in a mood where you hate your job and you're commuting 3 hours a day, like, these are all things that I think really tax your body. And so understanding what it does to your body and how to protect your mental state from those things. So, for example, I had a patient come in the other day who was saying, you know, my boss is driving me crazy, and she's really, her overall health is fine. We can't find anything wrong with her from her blood work and all of that stuff, but she feels awful all the time. And so one of the things, I mean, I can't tell her to quit her job or anything like that, you know, but one of the things I said to her was, you know, maybe we need to find a way to protect your mental state from this particular, you know, place that you're at with your job. And so what she's done, and actually has helped her a lot, is when she comes home from her work, she kind of separates herself from her job, and she thinks about, you know, her family and her kids and her husband, and she kind of reminds herself all of the great things that are about to come to her when she gets home, and she goes in and is much happier. And so I think even just understanding your mental state is a really big factor. And I think you have a lot of health providers, I think, who listen to your podcast, right? Something that really helped me was, you know, even having boundaries as well. Like, a lot of my patients have a lot of really serious health issues that I get very connected with. I treat a lot of women's health, you know, they go through fertility issues, miscarriages, and I get really emotional about it. And so I sort of have this, you know, breathing system where I just sort of separate my emotions from their issues after going through the visit, because otherwise you can take it home with you, and it really weighs down on you. So I think energy and mental state are really big indicators of telling you what's going on in your life.
And when you're looking at mental state of patients, do you find, in working with a lot of women, do you find boundaries are a consistent theme that comes up for people?
I do. Yeah. And definitely with a lot of women, for sure, because we have this expectation, societal, personal expectation of, this is how I should be. This is how, you know, life should be. This is what I should do. And I find that, you know, in many populations, everyone has certain expectations, but I do find it's a really, really big factor. People are not really able to take time for themselves.
Yeah. It's, I find that to be a very significant source of stress for the women in my practice is mm-hmm. is knowing how to establish those boundaries in a way that still feels compassionate and authentic and not bitchy, as it were.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
I feel like there's an art to that, and I do see a struggle, and I see a struggle with women. I'm gonna say 25 to like mid 30s is, I feel like, a real decade where you're like, oh, boundaries make a difference. I don't know how to do it. How do you remain compassionate in your establishment of boundaries?
Yeah, you know, I really get involved with my, because I care so much, and I think a lot of women feel this way. And so I try to, as much as possible, stay present with my patient, but also sort of realize that it's their issue, not mine. And I think that also transcends to the family life, you know, with your kids. And I actually see it, the 25 to mid 30s, I think, is also an issue, but I've noticed it more recently, even through into the mid 40s, where women are going through, you know, menopausal transitions, their kids are maybe a little bit older, they're getting independent, and they're starting to realize, who am I? Like, I'm so used to giving myself to everyone else. Like, who, you know, what is it for me? Who am I? Can I actually do something for myself? So I think we're so used to giving ourselves. It is a real art and tricky to stay present with someone, but also realize that that's yours. I can be there for you. I can support you. I can empathize with you, but I can't take it on because it's not mine.
Yeah, I love that. I, you know, just like a really short story, because it was top of mind for me. It happened for me last weekend. And I will preface this with, Brené Brown talks about the establishment of boundaries as being something that enables us to be generous. And the stronger our boundaries are, the more we can be authentically generous. And this hit home for me last weekend, because I was sitting there and I was having some water and I was really tired. Like, you talk about that energy piece. I was like, I have mm-hmm. a virus. Like, I'm not a napper. I would sleep 3 times a day. Like, I was tired. And mm-hmm. I was sitting and drinking water, and my daughter came up and she took my water and she started to drink it. And I got really angry with her, and I was mm-hmm. like, get your own water. And my husband was blown away. He's like, no, you'd like, you can't do that, and they're your kids, and you just give. And I was like, it was really such an interesting moment for me, where I was like, it was sort of this out of body experience where I was like, oh gosh, like, my boundaries came in a very rapid and aggressive way towards my 5-year-old daughter who stole my water. But it's because I got pushed so far beyond them, and it mm-hmm. was really my responsibility to have established those well in advance through how I engage and behave around them all the time, so that you don't hit that wall where you start to lose it.
Yeah, I love that, because you really can't be generous if you feel taken advantage of or you feel tapped out. And, you know, an interesting thing you asked me earlier, you know, how I sort of moved through this career. And one of my really very personal, I guess, experiences at the beginning of my career, very early on, I had a patient who, you know, I almost felt like she was a stalker. She was just always there. And so it was like, I would try as much as I could to help her, and she just couldn't move forward. It was like she just constantly wanted to be talking to me, emailing me, you know. And so very early on, I learned in my practice how to establish boundaries so that I could help her and other patients, but without feeling like they were draining me, because otherwise I wasn't able to be the best practitioner that I wanted to be. But interestingly, when I went into academia, it took me a long time to figure that out, because when I would go and talk at these conferences to pediatricians and, you know, medical doctors and pharmacists, there was always some people who really were open-minded and respectful, and there was always one, you know, the heckler in the back that wasn't. And I felt like for a while I was so passionate about changing the profession and moving things forward and opening young minds and, you know, all these things. But there was a time after I had my kids, that was when it actually changed, because I felt tapped out in the rest of my life. I just couldn't, I didn't have the energy to deal with that one person, you know. And I think we really have to not be affected by that one person. We have to really focus on all the positives. That's sort of where I had to really redirect my energy, because it was too draining to focus on that negativity. And so it was a really interesting transition for me too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it plays such an important role in so many areas of your lives. And I would encourage people, like, if you find you're driving down the road and you're angry at everyone, or you're frustrated with all the parents pulling into the parking lot at daycare, and no, I'm not talking about myself right now, like, that's a good time to check in on your own boundaries, because you've probably so far, you've let people just ease their way into your world with such consistency that that you have no room for yourself. So gently push back and gently really create a perimeter for yourself. There's nothing wrong with it. The world will benefit from you being happy, not angry.
Oh, for sure. And don't you feel so much more energy and excitement for your family and your practice after you've been away for a few days? It's just, it's amazing.
Totally. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a conversation I certainly have with lots of my patients and also my entrepreneurial coaching clients. We talk about how do we put those boundaries in play. And to that effect, I would love to learn a little bit more about your journey as an entrepreneur, because you alluded to this earlier that, you know, and you're like, when I opened my third practice, and I was like, oh gosh, like, so you went away for a weekend and you came out with a PhD and you started three practices and now you're looking into this online space. And what's really cool is that you can speak to the health component of what our audience is looking for, but you also get their journey. Tell us a little bit about your entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah, I don't like being told what to do. So I've always been an entrepreneur. I've just never been able to hold like an actual job. I think the clinical practice thing was really interesting. I started off in downtown Toronto, and unfortunately, the place that I was working, I had built, you know, a full-time busy practice. I loved it there. It was a great multidisciplinary health clinic, and then it got sold. And we were essentially evicted, and I had, you know, 30 days notice to get out. And so I couldn't even sell my practice. I basically had to let everyone go. I was looking for another location, but at the time I was pregnant and I was doing a postdoc at McMaster. So it just sort of, you know, we needed to move out of the city. And so I started again somewhere else. And unfortunately, again, the same thing. I built it up. It was successful. I was happy with it. I loved where I was. And again, it was sold. This time to another health provider who had a different philosophy from me. And so although I could have stayed there, the philosophy didn't match mine. And I really didn't feel comfortable being in a place where, you know, my philosophy didn't match the person who was the owner. I didn't feel like that resonated with me. I didn't feel like that was a happy place for me. So again, exactly. Yeah. You have to do what you think is right. And I thought, you know, I'd rather be not working than working in a situation that's going to be, you know, not comfortable for me or my patients. And so again, it was sort of a 30-day notice, unfortunately, and I had to pick up and move again. So I've done this, you know, three or four times, not out of choice. That's sort of the perils of not owning your own location. But it's been a really amazing experience to be able to build up and to have that confidence to know that I can do it anywhere I go. And so the entrepreneurial journey from a clinical practice was that. The online stuff is really more, I just wanted to challenge myself. I'm in a place in my career. My kids are a bit older. I feel like I really want to do something that's interesting for me and something that allows me to be creative and have an outlet and help more people than I can help in person. And so that's sort of where the online stuff has. But I definitely do understand the entrepreneurial journey. I've dabbled in entrepreneurial stuff, even outside healthcare. You know, we had some real estate that we were renting out, and we had, you know, so I've done a bunch of other things as well. And I think it's always really exciting, but it can really be draining too, because it's really hard to, you know, turn that off, right? Like it's all, you know, billable hours, and, you know, it's really hard to take that time for yourself and realize that, oh, that's going to impact my bottom line, you know? So there is a balance always.
Absolutely. And that's what's so cool about an entrepreneurial spirit is really, like you mentioned, that billable hour piece. It's pulling in that entrepreneurial brain to be like, okay, how do I leverage beyond that?
Yes, model. Exactly.
Yeah. And where do you see yourself in 5 years? Where do you think this journey is going to take you?
Oh, that's such a good question. I'm not sure. I have sort of, I'm sort of simmering with, you know, writing a book and doing, you know, I think right now it's kind of freeing to know that I'm not doing it for, you know, building. I already have a practice. I'm satisfied in my practice. I'm doing it more for the creative outlet piece. So it's kind of, it feels really freeing. I can do whatever I want and see where it takes me. So I want to, you know, write a book or, you know, do some online courses or, you know, I'm starting to use Instagram and social media. I was so not into them before. And it's actually really fun to learn and to be connected. I've connected with so many really interesting groups of people, and especially living in the suburbs, like it's really a nice way to keep in touch with people. So I just right now feel really stimulated by it. And I feel like, you know, I have all this knowledge to share. And I've so far gotten really good feedback about, hey, you know, that was really helpful. I had a patient who had a friend who read one of my blog posts and ended up going to a different doctor because of something I said, and had some blood tests done and ended up getting pregnant because of it, you know, after 10 years of trying. And I was like, that's super cool, you know. So Yeah, I don't know where it's going to take me, but I'm really excited to explore and see what happens.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. What do you want your legacy to be?
Well, I do a lot of fertility work, so I really do want someone to name their kid after me.
That's awesome.
Think that'll ever happen?
No, could.
Really, I just want to I want to empower people to live healthier lives. I think a lot of times I see people who fall through the cracks and they just don't get the answers that they need. And I just want to empower people to really, live their best life.
How would you define health?
I think health is the continuation of that. It's the freedom and capacity to live life to the fullest.
We've all heard that mindset has a huge influence on our ability to be effective and amplify in this world. But what if I told you your brain biochemistry, literally the neurotransmitters that are existing within your nervous system, can help amplify your mindset or your capacity to be effective? They can help accelerate your mission in the world. More and more with both my coaching clients and my patients, we end up having a conversation related to our own ability to control our nervous system through the optimization of neurotransmitters. Now, what the heck do I mean by this? The foods that you eat, the way that you think, your interaction with the world has the capacity to increase things like serotonin or dopamine, some of these really important neurotransmitters to helping you be effective and operate at your best. After listening to literally thousands of conversations with my clients and with my patients, I pulled together a very quick checklist so that you could have a better understanding of the things you're doing every single day to amplify your nervous system or downregulate it in a way that isn't necessarily serving your mission. If you want access to this information and want to learn a little bit more about how you can optimize your brain health for success, visit meganwalker.com/brainhealth to grab your handout now. Now, back to our episode. What a perfect place to transition to the second part of the interview on that really great definition. And the second part of the interview are something that I call KPIs or key performance indicators. So just like we have these when we're measuring the success of a business, I believe we also have these when we're measuring our health. And so I've got six quick questions that give us insight into some of the KPIs and values in your own health. Are you ready?
Sure.
All right. Do you have a consistent morning routine? And if so, can you share?
Oh, you found me out. I have been wanting to have a morning routine forever. And I just, if I could make my bed and put away the clean dishes from the night before, that is a good day for me. So morning routine is something I'm still striving for. But I do have a bedtime routine because I feel like sleep is one of the major issues that, everyone has. But for me in particular, I think sleep is a really big issue. So I have a very particular bedtime routine. I do something for my physical body. Maybe it's a walk, it's yoga, it's stretching, it's a hot shower, something that relaxes me physically. And then I do something that relaxes me mentally, whether it's deep breathing or meditation, or I read a lot. So, it's reading an actual physical book before bed, just something that kind of allows me to separate my day and my night. And so I think the bedtime routine is sort of where I'm at.
Fiction or nonfiction, what are you reading right now?
I always have at least three books at my bedside table. So right now I'm reading, it's a nonfiction. It's called The Adversity Advantage. Have you heard of it?
I haven't, but I feel like I'd like it.
Yeah, it's about this guy his name is Eric Weihenmeier, I think is how you pronounce his last name. And he climbed Mount Everest, which is, in and of itself, amazing. But oh, by the way, he's also blind.
Oh
and
my
so
gosh.
So he talks about his journey, and then the co-author, who is, I think, an adversity expert, talks about, lessons and frameworks for how you, I guess, surpass your obstacles. And actually, it's not about what you experience, but how you react to your experience of life or your challenges. So he talks about how to react to challenges in life to make you overcome.
It's on my list. As you're speaking, I added it to my list.
Awesome.
What is the one thing you are most consistent with respect to your health?
You're going to laugh. I think it's analysis. I analyze what's going well for me and what is not going well for me.
That's amazing. I love it. What is something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
I'm an adventurer and I love extreme sports. So I have done skydiving twice. I've been canyoning. I've been, you know, rafting, like any extreme sports, and I'm all over it.
You love it. Totally badass. And this might capture that. What do you do for fun or play?
It's usually something adventurous. So I travel. I love to travel. I've been to many places around the world and have many left on my list. And I dance. Those are the two sort of creative outlets for me.
Amazing. And our last question, entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
It's an interesting question. I think the skills can always be learned, but the drive to do, I think that's innate.
The thing that I love about this question is that everyone's answers are so different, but I feel like it's so insightful in terms of their own experiences and what they've observed in the world. And I really appreciate your time and perspective on all of it today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Walter, people are going to want to follow up with you. Where can they find you and some of the really cool stuff that you're up to?
Yeah, totally reach out on my website and social media. It's just my name, rishmawalji.com. And yeah, I would love to hear from people.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for being here and have an awesome day.
Thank you. You too.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Anthropology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.